Welcome back to Speaking Science, where we translate the science that affects your daily life. I'm Rachel Morris.
And I'm Alyssa Prizer. In this series, we're looking at how science intersects with other areas of our lives. In our first podcast in the series, we talked with Cheryl Kirschenbaum about science and politics. Today, we've asked Cheryl back to discuss the representation of science in the media. Welcome back.
Thanks so much.
We're so glad you could come back and join us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's an interesting topic, the science and the media intersection, because we're so inundated with media in our daily lives. It used to be if you wanted to learn about a topic, you went to the library or to a book or to a journal. And now we just Google it, and that leads to such a wide range of reporting on the same topic.
And a lot of science tends to be a really hot topic in the news, a lot of times because it's so controversial. So whether it's climate change or outbreaks or vaccines or technology, this tends to be what we're talking about a lot of the time.
So at least to us, it seems like that. Is it really the case that science is getting a ton of media coverage, or do I just feel like that because that's the part that I read?
I wish I could agree with you. I think it would be great if science was covered a ton. What we see, so the last stat I read, which was when I was working on my book, was that for every 5 hours of cable news, we're lucky if we see 1 minute devoted to science and technology. And most often that 1 minute is about our health and diet. So it's rare that we see cable news or media outlets covering science that's really shaping our lives on a global scale, even a personal scale. I hope that that's changing a bit. I certainly think as we're going into flu season now, we hear a lot more about things like the flu vaccine. I mean, that's good, but I think we can certainly do a lot better.
Interesting. Yeah. So I wondered if it was just me. I thought it might be. Because that's what my eye goes to, right? If there's one thing on the page of 20 stories, that's where my eye goes. I had a feeling.
And keep in mind, too, social media is so tailored to our interests, right? So what we're clicking on is teaching those algorithms what we want to see. So even though to us, what's trending or what's out there might seem so pro-science, most of the people that we're encountering aren't seeing those same keywords.
That is so important to think about. So in general, even though it's a small piece, how well is that small piece being translated from the research and the researchers' world into that general media?
That's a really big question. There are wonderful science storytellers and science journalists. There are a lot of very poor storytellers and journalists as well. So I think it's hard to generalize in that way. I mean, I can certainly think of some wonderful people, Carl Zimmer, Ed Young, Rebecca Skloot, science writers who tell very great, accurate, wonderful stories and capture public imagination and stress why a lot of the topics they cover are so important. But for all of those, I can think of countless individuals who, for example, have interviewed me and I've spoken to them and they've gotten things either completely wrong or at times I find things come back to me where I'm quoted and I look at the journalist's name and I realize I've never even spoken to that person and they're making up quotes. So there's a lot of bad science journalism out there. And that's the tip of the iceberg because we're also talking about films. We're talking about social media. I think that we have a long way to go, but I'm going to be optimistic here. I think there are ever more opportunities for people with scientific expertise to move into those spaces and tell better stories.
So sticking on the topic of news for a little bit, how do we start to tell those good stories from those bad stories? So when they do come across our Facebook feeds or things like that, we see something that seems important. How do we tell if this is something we should be listening to?
Well, I think that's a really great question coming from you because a podcast like this is probably a good part of the solution. You know, when scientists make themselves visible, come out, speak in a way where they're identifiable by media outlets looking to tell better stories, I think that places a lot more value in what they have to say. And it's very hard. Like, stepping back a bit, most Americans can't even name a scientist. And when they do, they often pick names like Al Gore or Bill Gates or folks that have passed away, like Albert Einstein. So it's very hard for journalists and just generally members of the public to figure out who to trust on science issues. I think more of us need to be visible, need to be out there speaking with our expertise, and need to make ourselves accessible to the people that are out there trying to tell these stories, or they're going to find special interests with specific agendas looking to tell those stories for us.
I think that's a great answer. And I think that it's a challenge to be the voice, though, because I feel like you get a lot of pushback when you say things people don't want to hear. So how do you how do you deal with that? I'll just give you an example. So I'm from Maine, which is one of the worst states for Lyme disease, right? We used to lead in incidence. Vermont has finally taken the role of that, which we're thankful for, I guess. Poor Vermont. But when I go home, I hear a lot of inaccurate information, especially about diagnostics for Lyme disease, which is sort of my area. Well, not sort of. It is my area of expertise. And yet it's very hard to engage with that in a way that I feel like people want to hear.
I think that's fair, but I think it's really important that we all try to stay engaged. I mean, most of the challenge has to do with the fact that scientists generally, not you, but generally, are really good at sharing the facts and providing information, but not always great at building trust and building relationships and building a lot of these important parts of giving someone a reason to listen to what you have to say. Now, when you're going home to Maine, I'm sure you're talking to friends and family. I encounter the same thing. Every time I'm in Northern California with my family, people are saying, oh, well, you didn't get a vaccine, did you? Or there's a lot of crystals out there. Not that there's anything wrong with people who like crystals, but it's a different way of thinking about how our world works. When I had my son in Austin, a lot of the same thing. Am I only buying organic food? Well, if I'm not, why not? But generally, I'm having those conversations with people who actually know me in real space, not on some social media platform online that circulates lots of pseudoscience and misinformation. And those people might have another reason to trust what I have to say because they know me in another context. So I think, I mean, this is part of a much bigger conversation, but I think finding things that you have in common with a person, building a relationship over time, giving them some real reason to take time and pause and think about where you're coming from, ultimately builds to this place where maybe they might take you a little more seriously over time. And we're not going to convince everyone. We're not going to convince people who have already made up their minds and are not going to be willing to listen to a thing anyone else has to say. And we don't need to convince some people who are just going to be on board with whatever we have to talk about. But I think if I always think of a bell curve, I think most people are somewhere in the middle. They want accurate information. They're not sure where to turn. So repeatedly interacting with them, giving them a sense of who you are, building a relationship, all of that leads to better science literacy.
So one of the things that you see in the media is when we do come across science stories, it tends to be very extreme. It's either the worst thing in the world that could happen or the best thing in the world that could happen. So as people reading these stories, how do we balance the hopefulness of new discoveries? There are a lot of really cool things happening and that we could do with them, but also balancing there's a context for how this research was done, and especially for people who don't have training in that, how do you start to balance that, whether you're reading or whether you're writing these stories?
Well, I wish I knew, because I feel like every news agency is grappling with that right now. I like to joke, but I'm not really joking, that every time if you visit CNN.com, the world is ending for a different reason. Mm-hmm. So there's an asteroid about to hit us, but it might not, or everyone's going to die of Ebola. And those are just the science stories, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a ton of other things. And a lot of it is because of clickbait and the way that we use media, and they have to, even articles that we write as journalists, we don't choose the headline. So you might have a very careful way of explaining something in an article with some nuances and the context, and then the headline is something that is maybe even counter to your argument, but you don't always have control over that. So I think that's the product of the way we use media now, and I know I haven't answered your question, but I think it's a really big question. I don't know the answer.
And I feel like there's another step back from that. So when I read one of those articles that, you know, gets my attention, which obviously the science ones do, and then I, because of my training, I go back and I look at the real articles, right? I go back to the research that this article came from, and sometimes there's a real disconnect there too. And I feel like explaining to people how you put these hopeful new discoveries in a context of where they really are in the field is really important. Do you have any insight into how to help people understand that? Or,
well, something that I try to do, and I think more of us in the science community working in these spaces can think about, is how to, I said this earlier, but how to make ourselves more accessible as experts that can be quoted or people can come to with questions. I mean, when you think about who are the spokespeople for science, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson is wonderful. I think Bill Nye is wonderful. But if you're looking for a science quote on I don't know, water security, I don't necessarily think that they're the best people to go to for answers. I think there are so many people out there doing amazing work, women, people of color, just scientists in generally that maybe don't fit the mold that people expect, that we should be hearing more from. And part of the responsibility of that, I think, should also be on scientists to get out of their labs, to start meeting people, to show up at town halls, to show up at events, and to be available to discuss why these issues are important. And I think that would have a trickle-down effect where then journalists would say, oh, I have a question, and, you know, I thought of someone, and it's not Bill Nye. And they might have an idea about this. And not to go on a tangent, but I'm thinking about what you said. Another example, I work, one of the things I do at Michigan State University is I run this national survey, this national poll. We survey over 2,000 Americans, age 18 and older. All the demographics are very carefully weighted to represent what we see in the U.S. Census. I constantly, especially as elections come and go, hear about these polls that they're quoting, that 90% of people say this and 50% of people say this. And then I look at their methods and they've asked 200 people, but that doesn't make the headline. And then you equate these things as being equal and they're not. So maybe it's the responsibility of us as citizens to try to look a little closer at the research, the methods, the polling, whatever was done, and figure out, does that actually make sense? Is there a real story here? Or is this just something that is shiny that they're trying to wave in front of people to get clicks and therefore revenue?
One of the other things you mentioned besides news was also movies. So do you have some examples of movies that have done science well and maybe some that have taken some liberties?
I definitely do. The one that I like to point to, it wasn't a popular movie, it came out when I was in college. I think it was called Red Planet. And it was about a bunch of scientists that went to Mars. And I just remember this, and I probably think it's such an egregious example because my husband's a geneticist, so we talk about this. But one of the main characters is a geneticist, and he's doing something or other. And he says, I speak in the language of DNA, A, T, G, and P. And for those who don't know, P is not one of the base pairs of DNA. It was the kind of thing where maybe it's a small detail, but someone's, I don't know, teenager probably could have helped them get that right. And I don't want to nitpick. I don't want to say that every movie has to get science exactly right, because I understand it's about entertainment. It's about captivating audiences. But I think there's a real argument to be made that getting the science right tells a more compelling story. And I'm not the only one to feel that way. The National Academies launched around 2008, it might be 2009, they launched the Science and Entertainment Exchange. It's based in Los Angeles, and the role of that is to partner filmmakers with people doing extraordinary science that's changing our world. So helping producers and directors and writers tell more accurate stories, to really get people excited about science as well, because it serves two purposes, right? It captures public imagination, and then it helps inform filmmakers to do a better job. So I think that's a really kind of encouraging change that we've seen. I think The Big Bang Theory as a show does a pretty accurate job. I mean, I've had some pushback on that when I say that in public talks, because people are a little bit offended by the personalities. But to that I say, one, they have actual astrophysicists who are writing those equations in the background, who are being careful that the bookshelves that you see match what a bookshelf might look like in an MIT office or a Caltech office. And on top of that, I feel like even though some people find those characters offensive, I think I've interacted with all of versions of them in real life, and that's fine and fun. And, you know, maybe they're an extreme, but we are quirky as a community.
I think I've seen versions of those in myself over time, too.
Okay.
I'm a microbiologist married to an engineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. The progress that we see in the media, I think, or in entertainment media. So one of the shows that's come out recently is The Good Doctor. That portrays the laboratory, which is my field, the medical laboratory, is actually existing. The doctors aren't doing the testing. They did try to bribe the laboratory with a raspberry donut in one episode, and I did tweet about that, saying, now, hold on.
I was going to say, would that actually work for you?
No.
Right for me.
It doesn't move you to the front of the line. But that, you know, that sort of thing, just portraying that we exist is a new thing and an exciting thing. So I do think there's some progress. I think there's still lots of progress to be made. I love seeing people pipette on TV because they really don't know how. My students will be like, that is not right. Yeah, I know. But still, just to see someone pipette, that exists, you know, that's progress.
The Martian was amazing for science.
I think that
was one of the best ones.
Yep.
And even Avatar, where no, you couldn't have these floating mountains. But you know what? They incorporated bioluminescence. And they asked researchers what skulls of certain animals might look like if they had these qualities. So they're thinking a little more holistically about how to do it. And I just love that.
Absolutely. I use The Martian as a case study in one of my classes. I also use an episode of Called the Midwife, which portrays a lot of human health issues that we deal with in my field. So
I particularly love The Martian because I do plants. So I was very happy to see the potatoes make an appearance.
Important appearance.
It's
a vital appearance.
Vital. Plants are vital.
So we've talked a little bit about like these jobs that are out there for people who can communicate science and people who do it well. Do you have any advice for people who might be listening who think that might be something they would want to do?
I'd say stay adaptable. And I mean, for me, you know, I went to grad school. I finished in 2005. I didn't have to do any public speaking as part of my career or part of my degree. It just, science communication wasn't quite a thing the way it is now, and it hasn't been so long since then. And so I feel like there wasn't much in the way of science blogs, or YouTube hadn't even started yet, I think. And we've seen this explosion of new opportunities. I have friends that have series on PBS Digital Studios. I have friends that are doing crazy stuff in podcasting and in video and things that I don't even, Twitch, I can't even tell you what Twitch is, but people are using it, and you probably know more about it than I do. Maybe that's a bad example. I hope that's not offensive to anyone. I don't know what they actually use on Twitch. But the point is, all of these new formats for communicating about every type of science or engineering thing, they're all changing. And there's no one way to do it right. So I think a lot of this is about figuring out what you're comfortable with, trying your voice at a science cafe or a public talk, chatting with journalists, thinking about what a career in science journalism, even science policy and science engagement might look like. There's new opportunities all the time from places like the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The Union of Concerned Scientists has some great opportunities. There's more and more and more. So if you don't know where to find them, people can absolutely reach out to me. I'm very easy to find. It's just Cheryl@sciencedebate.org. But I have a whole list of fellowships and scholarships and opportunities that I like to share with young people thinking about where they're headed. And again, just to repeat, my career, which I never know what it's going to look like in 5 years, didn't exist when I was a student. So there are so many opportunities. And I think it's a very exciting time to be thinking about these questions.
And I know for people in the public who might want to interact with these, a lot of these events are open. I know a couple students that I work with, I think they have an astronomy on tap night. So try to find events like that. They're usually on Facebook, I think. But there's lots of events where you can interact directly with science and talk with the scientists doing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, college campuses or university campuses are a great place to look for those things, too, because generally those sort of talks are open to the public. And there's stuff like that going on a lot around here, I know. I guess I want to thank Cheryl for coming again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening today. You can find all of our resources on our website, www.speakingsciencepodcast.com. And you can find us on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and also Spotify now.